second, so let me tell you a little bit. Oh, this, okay, good. So what I'm going to do schematically is I'm going to describe a general machine, the expansions machine. And it's a machine which takes topics in topology into problems in algebra. And the machine itself actually is somehow inspired by analysis. So if you do analysis, you also have a little bit something to touch there. Okay? But the machine, there are many things I can apply this machine to. But I'm not going to, I'm going to apply it in just one example, which is a certain particular type of two-dimensional knots in R4. So much of the talk will be a description of the machine, and then a description of what are two-dimensional knots in R4, and then I'll state a theorem, or the statement maybe will come right at the beginning, and the theorem will be that the machine takes this topic in topology into that, into a certain problem in algebra. So maybe I'll start with that problem in algebra, and I'll only sketch what it is without much detail. And it's the so-called Kashiwara-Verne problem. So here it is. So the Kashiwara-Verne conjecture, which is now a theorem by Alexeyev and Meinrenke and further elucidated by Alexeyev and Torossian. So it says that there exists two series. So at first it will appear completely bizarre, okay? But then I will explain what it does, okay? So there exists two series F and G in the freely algebra FL in two generators X and Y that solve a pair of equations which are awful to write and even more awful to understand. Okay? So, first of all, what is the freely algebra? So, I hope it is fair to assume that everybody knows vaguely, what it is, what's a Lie algebra? Is it a fair assumption? So, again, a Lie group is a group of symmetries, a continuous group of symmetries, and usually, if you have a continuous group of symmetries, so I don't know, here's the group, and it sort of looks like a manifold, then if you look at the tangent space, here's the identity, if you look at the tangent space near the identity, then this is the Lie algebra. And it turns out that it contains enough structure in it to recover essentially the whole group. Not quite, but a lot about the whole group. More precisely, a Lie algebra is something, a vector space, V, or a vector space L, with a bilinear bracket on it, which satisfies two properties. So one is that it's anti-symmetric, and the second, so in other words, the bracket of x and y is equal to negative the bracket of y and x, and the second property is the so-called Jacobi identity, which says that the bracket of x with the bracket of y and z plus all cyclic permutations of the same things is equal to zero. Good. So now what's the freely algebra in X and Y? The freely algebra in X and Y is basically the smallest Lie algebra, or the Lie algebra you can write by starting from two elements. You assume that there are two elements, X and Y, and you impose no relations whatsoever. So the freely algebra will contain, first of all, X, then it will contain Y, but since it has a bracket, it must contain the bracket of X and Y, but since I want it to be a Lie algebra, I impose the relation that this is the negative of the bracket of Y and X. So the bracket of X and Y is just a new element that I put into the Lie algebra. And then, well, it has to be closed under taking brackets, so there should be also elements like the bracket of X and Y, sorry, the bracket of this with the bracket of X with the bracket of X and Y. But then you mod out by all the relations that make it a Lie algebra. So you mod out by the Jacobi relations of all in all possible ways and by the anti-symmetry relation. Now, things like that can be reinterpreted as a tree, as trees. Okay? So, basically, you connect
two things. So you turn this into the tree, which has two leaves, X and Y, connected to a vertex. So this is a binary tree, out of which, so the vertex stands for the bracket, and this side becomes X and Y connected by a bracket to an X, which is bracketed with that, and these two are bracketed together. So here is the tree representing this. Okay? So, in other words, the Frehley algebra in X and Y is equal to some set of trees whose leaves are labeled by X and Y. So trees with labeled leaves modulo whatever these relations become when you translate them into trees. It's not hard to see what they are, but it's besides the point right now.
But it should be the vector space generated by these
trees. Yeah, of course. So linear combinations may be over the rationals. Thanks. Because I want everything to be a vector space. Okay. So that's a Frehley algebra. The Frehley algebra is graded. Every element in the Frehley algebra has a degree. Basically, by declaring that the degree of x and the degree of y are 1, and then the degree of x times y, bracket y, will be 2, and the degree of anything will be the number of x's and y's that appear in it. So the degree of this element will be 5. And what I'm actually looking at is the completed Frehley algebra. So I allow myself infinite sums, like power series as opposed to polynomials, but these are infinite sums in which the degrees are rising, so there are no convergence issues. Okay? And then the Kashiwara-Verne conjecture say that within this Frehley algebra, there exist two elements, F and G, which satisfy two messy equations, one written in itself in the space of Frehley algebras, and another is written in a certain space of cyclic words, which is obtained by closing such Frehley algebra elements into cycles in a certain way, it doesn't matter what. And all of these ugly formulas are really ways of manipulating trees, combining these trees together in certain funny ways with certain coefficients. But the point is that it's a conjecture that says two series, you can solve a pair of equations in a graded space, in a pair of graded spaces, where the unknowns are two series, again in a graded space. Okay? Now, of course, so far it should look completely horrible. Why should you care? So why is this interesting? So it's interesting. Oh, oops. Bad news. Oh, no, it's okay. Sorry, I thought it was cutting some of the screen, but it wasn't. Sorry, okay, that's fine. So it turns out that this conjecture implies a very strange statement about the relationship between Lie algebras and Lie groups. So you see, if you have an invariant function or a pair of invariant functions, say defined on the Lie group, so here is one function, I don't know, I'm maybe drawing the level sets, and here is another one, okay, and they are invariant, whatever that means, invariant by the under the action of the group on itself, by conjugation, well, you can pull these two functions back to the Lie algebra. There is a natural map from the Lie algebra to the group. Visually, you can call it projection, but it's really called exponentiation. And you can pull these two functions back to being functions on the Lie algebra. Okay? And then the claim, the Kashiwara-Verne statement, is that if you take the convolution of these two functions in the group using the Haar measure, whatever that is, some invariant measure on the group, and then you pull it back to the Lie algebra, you get the same thing as if you take the convolution, if you pull back the functions and take the convolution using the Lebesgue measure on the tangent space, on the Lie algebra. Okay? So you can imagine that this will have value in representation theory and in harmonic analysis, but let me just sketch very, very, very schematically how statements like this, a conjecture like the bizarre conjecture above, could be related to something so structural. So the point is that at the end of the day, you want to prove the equality of two integrals, right? And one integral is the convolution taken here in the group, and the other integral is the convolution taken in the Lie algebra. So first of all, you pull back the two integrals to be written on the same space. There is a natural identification between the two spaces, at least near the identity. So you can pull back the two integrals to be two integrals on the same space. And then you need to show that two integrals are equal. Okay? So one way to do it is to find a measure-preserving transformation. So, you know, I want to show that the integral of one function is equal to the integral of another function. I mean, these are somehow constructed in a hard way from the original functions I had to convolve. So I have to show that the integral of this is equal to the integral of that. And one way to do it is to find a measure-preserving transformation and to show that G is equal to composed with this measure-preserving transformation. And then the integral of F will be the integral of this, and then the two integrals will be equal. Now, I somehow want to find a measure-preserving transformation from the Lie algebra to itself, which will take one integrand to another. And I want to do it for all Lie algebras in the world at the same time. So the way to do it is to write formulas which make sense in all Lie algebras at the same time. But any such tree can be interpreted as a formula. Basically, it's a formula to which you feed an element x and an element y, and it produces an output, some complicated bracket of the two elements. So these two series, f and g, can be interpreted as formulas for a transformation from the Lie algebra to itself. This is if you work hard. I mean, I'm not giving any details. I'm only telling you the schematics, okay? And then this formula has to satisfy, this transformation has to satisfy two properties. One, it has to pull back the function f to the function g, and this turns out to be the first of the two Kashiwara-Verne equations. And it has to be measure-preserving. This turns out to be the second of the two Kashiwara-Verne equations. So again, by a long Lie theoretic game, this strange conjecture becomes this structural statement about Lie algebras. And I've obviously lied to you in many places. This is a loosely stated statement. I mean, I'm skipping various Jacobians and various other little things. But at least the sketch should be clear. Is it okay so far? Okay. So now it's time to describe the machine. Okay, I told you what is the algebra problems that the machine will produce. Now I'll tell you what the machine is, and then I'll tell you what is the topology that I feed into the machine. The machine is actually something that you can completely understand, even if the first part was a bit loose. Okay? So here's the machine. So let's start with G be a group, any group whatsoever, actually has nothing to do with this Lie group, nothing whatsoever, okay? But the kind of groups that I like to think about are groups made out of topological objects. So for example, the braid group. So I hope you know what the braid group is, but if not, the braids are basically pictures like this, and which are regarded up to motions in which strands are not allowed to cross each other, and they are composed by stacking them one on top of each other. So that's the kind of groups I think about. But the input could be any group whatsoever. Let K be the group ring of G. So it's the set of formal linear combinations, some AI, GI, finite, in which the AIs are rational numbers and the GIs are elements of the group. Okay? Let I, so okay, K is a ring, because you can, basically you can multiply such products, to such products by formal multiplication, by multiplying group elements and then multiplying their coefficients, and sort of using bilinearity. Let I be the augmentation ideal of K. So the augmentation ideal is simply those linear combinations whose sum of coefficients is equal to zero. Now, whenever you have an ideal inside a ring, you can form its powers, right? The product, so I to the M will be product of M elements in the ideals. And these powers form a descending, a nested descending sequence of sub-ideals of our ring. And such a descending sequence of subspaces of the ring is called a filtration. But anyway, let A be the so-called associated graded of K. And this is, well, you take the mth element, the mth power of the augmentation ideal, you mod it out by the m plus first power of the augmentation ideal, which I already told you is something smaller. So you look at I to the m modulo I to the m plus 1, and you sum over all m's, except you make it an infinite sum. This is the hat here. So you allow infinite sums, provided they are of higher and higher degrees. So m here is the degree, and you allow infinite sums if they are of higher and higher degrees. And then you can check that this associated graded inherits a product from the group, or maybe from the group ring. So it's an algebra. So out of any group, you can automatically produce an algebra. Okay? Maybe I'll skip the comment here, but there is some natural sense in which if you look at K modulo I to the M plus 1 and look at the dual of that, so basically functions on the ring which vanish on the M plus first power of the augmentation ideal, they are in some natural sense polynomials on the group. Polynomials defined on elements of the group. Okay, but anyway, and I'll come back to it in a slightly different language in a minute. So anyway, now the key definition. So a linear functional Z, or a linear map Z from K to A, so from the group ring to its associated graded, is called an expansion if it has the following property. So if whenever you evaluate it on an element gamma, which in itself is in the mth power of the augmentation ideal, then Z of gamma will be, so Z of gamma will be an infinite sequence, right? It will be an element in I to the 0 modulo I to the 1, plus an element, comma, an element in I to the 1 modulo I to the 2, comma, an element in I to the 2 modulo I to the 3. So it will be the sequence 0, 0, 0 until the nth place. In the nth place, you'll see gamma itself, or more precisely, its equivalence class modulo I to the n plus 1. And after that, I don't care what you will see. So that's an expansion. And a homomorphic expansion is an expansion which, in addition, takes the product here to the product here, preserves the product. Okay? And again, this this should all make sense on a formal level, but should not look intuitive. So now I want to give you two things that will make it a little more intuitive. So the first thing is an example which is not quite from within this context, but very, very similar. So let K, instead of being the group ring of a group, let it be the ring C infinity of Rn, so smooth functions on Rn. And let I, instead of being the augmentation ideal, be the set of the ideal of functions which vanish at zero. Okay? Then I to the power m, well, these are products of m functions, m smooth functions that vanish at zero. These are exactly functions that vanish like the mth power of x. And then functions that vanish m times, modulo functions that vanish m plus 1 times, are exactly homogeneous polynomials of degree m. If I sum over all m's, then I get that A, the associated graded, is power series on Rn. So I am seeking a linear map Z, which goes from functions on Rn to power series. And that and it turns out that the most natural example for such Z is the Taylor expansion. So the word expansion comes from Taylor expansion. Okay? So two comments. First of all, you know, this doesn't characterize the Taylor expansion. So the Taylor expansion is an example, but there are other examples as well. But if I had added another property, like something about the coproduct, so it turns out that both of these things are coalgebras, and if I had added this coproduct property, then that would be a characterization of the Taylor expansion. I just didn't want to go too far aside. Okay? And then the other point is that, so look what I have. I have a generalization of the notion of a Taylor expansion to completely our general context, to any group. It makes sense whenever you have a group. Okay. It's not always interesting, but often it is. Okay. Here's another aside, sort of just for fun, I want to tell you a different view of expansions. So here, K will not even be a ring. It will be the set of all pictures. Okay? Or more precisely, how do you think of a picture as being lots and lots of bright dots on R2? Okay? So basically, lots and lots of particles emitting light. And if they're sufficiently dense, then they make a picture. So really, a picture is simply the set of linear combinations of elements of R2 with coefficients in Q cubed, which are sort of the luminosities. How much brightness are in each property? And it's Q cubed because it's R, G, and B. Red, green, and blue. Okay? Now, let's define a descending filtration on it. So, basically, K1 will be the subset in which I identify all points of R2. So, it's as if I view this picture from far away and I no longer can tell the difference between a bright pixel here and a bright pixel here. So, if I look at a picture, or I look at the image of a picture modulo K1, all I see is its average brightness. Okay? K2 will be, I will identify two pixels if they live in the same quarter of this picture. So the image of this picture in K modulo K2, in pictures modulo the second filtration, will be like the, roughly, will look like the average brightness of the upper left, the average brightness of the upper right, well, the average brightnesses of the parts of the picture. Okay? And then so on. So sort of if you look at successive quotients, you see the picture clearer and clearer. Okay? So in a way, looking at successive pictures is like understanding in the world more and more, because you mod out by less and less. Okay? Now, what's an expansion in this context? So an expansion, you know, you remember the old times when you were connected to the internet via a modem. Half of the people here don't remember, sorry. But you know, you have lousy internet connection and you load a website and the pictures appear sort of, first you get a low resolution approximation and then it appears slowly at higher and higher resolution. So an expansion is the information you need to send in order to get a higher and higher resolution picture. So let me explain. So let's look at day three of sending the information, day four of sending the information. So at day four of sending the information, I have already sent you the information to understand this picture. And now I want to send you the further information that's necessary in order to understand this one, right? But of course, I don't want to resend the information in this one, so I don't want to send this information from scratch. In other words, I have already sent you the information in K modulo K3, and I need to tell you the stuff in K mod K4, which goes to zero in K mod K3. I need to tell you the new stuff, so the stuff which projects to nothing here. So I need to tell you the information. I need to send you the information in the kernel of the map from K modulo K4 to K modulo K3. Now play a little bit with linear algebra, and you'll find that this is just K3 modulo K4. So at day four of my process of sending the picture, I have to send information in K3 mod K4. So that would be that's precisely the data in the fourth coordinate of an expansion. So an expansion is precisely, so if you look at the expansion, first the first zeroth degree, then the first degree, then the second degree, and so on, you're exactly seeing the information that is being sent in a progressive scan of a picture. Okay? Yes.
Is that Q3? Q cubed?
Yeah, this is Q cubed, sorry. Okay. I guess it should have been R over. Well, yeah, I wanted to make a distinction between the coefficients and the point and the plane, the luminosities and the... Okay, anyway, it's not important. And finally, a homomorphic expansion is an expansion which will be compatible with various operations you can do in the picture. So, you know, if you have a picture, you can rotate it. And a homomorphic expansion will be an expansion, well, rotating the picture induces rotating some rotation operation here, and a homomorphic expansion would be an expansion that would make these rotations compatible. It's not trivial to find one. Okay? Okay, so that was just an aside. And now back to our context. So again, our context was group ring into its associated graded. Now, if in addition the group is finitely presented, meaning it is given to you by finitely many generators that satisfy finitely many relations, then in order to find a homomorphic expansion, you just have to define it on the generators. So you have to find finitely many elements in a graded space, the values of the expansion on the generators. And then, to be well defined, these elements that you're looking for have to satisfy the equations, the relations that the group is defined from. So you just have to find finitely many elements satisfying a certain system of equations written in a graded space, and that's a problem in algebra. Okay, so finding an expansion, a homomorphic expansion, is a problem in algebra. And you can... So my claim is that, you know, if you start from the braid group, and you ask yourself, can I find an expansion for it, then it becomes an interesting problem in algebra. And specifically, and this is the theorem that I want to talk to you about today, and it's joined with my former student, Zhuzhana Dancho. So specifically, I claim that there is a bijection between the set of homomorphic expansions for a certain collection of two-dimensional knots in R4, two-dimensional knotted objects in R4, and the set of solutions of the Kashiwara-Verne problem written above. which really means that to solve the expansion problem for two-dimensional nodes, you need to, if you solve that, you've also solved a question about convolutions in Lie groups and Lie algebras. Are you still with me, more or less? Okay. And also, this is the tip of a major iceberg. So there are other classes of knots and knotted objects and other things for which you can ask this question and sometimes answer and sometimes not. Okay. Forget everything I said so far. And now I want to tell you a little bit about the objects on which our expansions are defined. In other words, about two knots, two-dimensional knots in R4. So I guess I call it 4D knots here. Okay? So now it's fresh topic, something about two-dimensional knots. Now, what's a two-dimensional knot? So how do you draw a two-dimensional knot to start with? So here's a two-dimensional knot. Okay? So let's try to understand it a little bit. So the convention is, I suppose, the same convention as here. So this is a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional topological object. And the idea is that I draw the lines, and you think that the lines are in the plane of the blackboard, but when I draw a cut, when I make a cut in the line, what it really means is that, well, this goes behind. Or more formally, it means that the line continues, but the z-coordinate goes from being zero to being below zero temporarily. So it bypasses this strand from below. You all understand this very well, right? So this picture is the same except one dimension up. So it's a three-dimensional picture, meaning it's a two-dimensional surface. You can sort of see what the surface is. And this two-dimensional surface is placed in the R3 that you see when t is equal to zero, when the fourth coordinate is equal to zero. So it's mostly on this R3 where t is equal to zero, except occasionally you see a cut in it. So here, when this surface appears discontinuous, so you see a cut. The cut just means that the surface dips to t is less than zero, so goes down to t is less than zero for a brief moment, so as it can go under another piece of surface. So that's a two-dimensional knot in R4. By the way, it's kind of fun to try to understand it a little better. So let's try to understand it a little better. But the only way I could do it is if I had an eraser.
It's behind the screen, I think.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So let's try to understand this particular surface. So, I mean, just to sort of get a feel for it. So actually, I want to start understanding it from where it's easiest, from here. Over here, it's clear what we see. We see a tube, right? So we see a tube. Whatever, a tube. OK? Now let's go to the left and see what we see. So and try to understand what we see. So the tube bends. But topologically, for a topologist, it's still a tube. And then it goes above something, because the thing here, there is a big drum here, but there is a cut in it, so it goes above something. Right? So the tube continues and goes above. And then it's sort of like the bottom of a Möbius, of a Klein bottle. It sort of blooms over. I don't know if you can sort of visualize it. But it's still a tube, topologically. So it's still a tube, and it closes at the bottom, because the drum closes at the bottom. And as it closes, it goes under something, namely under itself. But that's still a tube, and there is sort of an exit tube out of it. So I guess it becomes a big drum, and something exits to the side. But topologically, this is just the same as the tube continues. Well, as it continues, it goes over something else, then under something else, and then it gets capped, so it gets closed, while going over something else. So topologically, the parameter space is just the tubes that got capped. That was going to the left. Now let's go to the right. So going to the right, I have my tube. It bends. That's still a tube. It's still a tube. It goes under something, actually something that we already talked about, but that's fine. It goes under something. Then it gets thicker and becomes this big drum. And as it gets thicker, it goes over something. And then it gets capped, and as it gets capped, it goes under something. But basically, it just became thicker and got closed. So that's a sphere. Okay? So here is an S2 embedded in R4 in a crazy way, and now you understand two-dimensional knots in R4. Are you okay? Are you with me? Here's another one. So, here, I've coded the third dimension, the fourth dimension, by color. So like in a topographical map, so red means high, or high temperature, and blue means cold, so low, okay? So, this is the knot. This is half of the knot, just so that you can see it's symmetric, it's like a shell. But you know, there is an apparent singularity here, but it's not a singularity because the colors are different. Okay, it's clearly a sphere, right? Well, basically, it's again a tube, which is capped on both ends. Okay, it's clearly a sphere. And by the way, if you look at this, if this was red throughout, right? If this whole tunnel here was red, then I could just slide this green out because it's always below, right? But it's not red throughout. In fact, sort of at some point in going between red and blue, the shade of green here is exactly the same shade as the green here. So if I try to pull it out, I will get two things at the same place and with the same color, and that's singular. Okay. So here's another color. Here's another knot in R4.
They're not the same.
They are the same.
Oh.
But it's very hard to see. Yes. Okay, they don't appear to be the same, but they are the same. Okay, and here's, by the way, some of these pictures are by Carter and Saito, and some are joined between me and Esther Dalvit. And here's a little movie showing you a different way of visualizing knots in R4. So you see, if you have a knot in R4, you can think of R4, you can think of T as time, and then if you slice R4 at any given T, you see a curve in R3. And a curve generically will be just a circle, and so a movie of flying circles in R3 really represents a two-dimensional knot in R4. So let's look at one of these movies. Click, apps, open. Okay, so here is a movie where yellow flew in the middle of red and then exchanged with blue, and then red flew through. I can't read colors. But anyway, here's the same thing viewed as a cut surface. So that's not quite a knot, but it's just four knotted tubes. It's more like a braid. Okay? Okay. Now, are you still okay? I still have 20 minutes. That's good. I have an hour, right? Okay. So there is a certain diagrammatic representation for a part of two knots in R4. So a part of this world of two knots in R4 has a diagrammatic representation, and let me start explaining it to you. So the ingredients are very similar to the ingredients of ordinary knot theory. Well, in ordinary knot theory, the basic ingredient is a crossing, and for two knots, the basic ingredient also looks like a crossing, but it represents something else. So to see what it represents, you need to inflate this line twice. first time to rebonds, and maybe I will not dwell on what this really means, but you first inflate it to rebonds, and then you inflate these rebonds to tubes. And this is, these are the tubes that you get after you do this inflation twice. So the lower line becomes a thinner tube, the upper line becomes a thicker tube, and the crossing becomes a funny picture where the thinner tube goes, what is it, over one side of the thicker tube, then in the middle of it, and then comes out by going under it. Under meaning in the fourth coordinate. Okay? Maybe I'll show you. Oh, and by the way, as a movie of flying rings, it's the movie in which you have two rings, blue is big and red is small, and they exchange places by red flying through blue. Okay? And you know what? Yeah, I'll show the movie. Why not? It's very short. So this is what it looks like from various sides. It's really, really short. Okay? Yeah, I think that's all. Okay. Then comes the next ingredient. So the next ingredient is the virtual crossing. And the virtual crossing has no analog in ordinary knot theory. So the virtual crossing is a crossing in which you don't specify which side is above and which side is below. And when you inflate it the first time, it becomes two bands in which one is above the other, and it doesn't matter which one is above the other. In the previous case, sort of one band went through the other. And here, they just go one over the other, and it doesn't matter which one is over. And when you inflate it the second time, they become, well, actually, sort of this picture is a little bit misleading. So it can be, they become two tubes that are one over the other. But we are in R4, so in fact, one over the other is equivalent to that one, to the other way. In fact, let's see it as the picture, because the picture represents it in a slightly different way. Here, it's represented by one tube that goes, you see, it's really, the red tube here goes under, above the blue tube on both sides, right? Because it cuts through on both sides. So let's see the picture, the movie. Where's my mouse? Don? Oh, here. Okay. Sorry. So here it is from various sides. But you see, since red is always above blue, it can just slide out, and soon it will. And it can slide out one way, or equally well, it could slide out the other way. So this is the virtual crossing. And as a thing about flying rings, you have two rings, and they exchange places externally. Right, the previous one was internally, and this is externally. Now, externally, it doesn't matter if it's that way, or that way, or that way, or basically there is a circle worth of directions in which they can interchange, but that just means that topologically they're all the same. Okay. Then there is another ingredient, and then the next ingredient is a cup. So basically, a line terminating with a bullet represents, well, a band that ends, and when you inflate it, it becomes a tube with which gets capped. Basically, what you see here. Okay? And then there is yet another ingredient which I didn't talk about before, and in fact, it's a little bit out of ordinary knot theory. So in ordinary knot theory, it can also be generalized a bit. Instead of talking about knots, things like this, you could talk about knotted graphs. So a graph which is embedded in R3. And then you'd have singularities where three strands meet. And there is a similar vertex, and in fact there are two of them with different orientations, but there are similar vertices that you can form in at one dimension up, and in the language of flying rings, it's two rings fly, 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 and then coincide, become one, and fly together. So if you want red and blue fly, 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 and until they coalesce, coincide, I don't know, and fly together as purple, because purple is, of course, the sum of red and blue. Okay? So these are my elementary ingredients. And now what's WK? Oh, sorry, so maybe examples. So, you know, here is one thing which becomes this picture. Maybe I don't want to say anything about it. Here's another. So, well, this picture, when inflated twice, becomes exactly this one, which you have seen already. Okay, so in other words, the lovely picture, where was it? Oops, I went too far. The lovely picture here, in this sort of simplified notation, becomes this picture. Okay? Okay, so now what is WK, the space on which I will look for expansions? So WK is the planar algebra generated by these three ingredients: the crossing, the virtual crossings, the vertex, and the cup. Modulus on relations. But first of all, what's a planar algebra? So I'm not going to give you a formal definition of a planar algebra, but, well, you know, it's kind of like a group. Instead of just having, you know, in a group you can only multiply from left to right, but in a planar algebra you can multiply from left to, basically you can put things side by side in the plane in arbitrary ways. So you can put things side by side in the plane in arbitrary ways, providing that the stuff written on the boundary matches. Okay? So basically, elements in a planar algebra look like cards on which stuff is written, and you can form bigger cards on which stuff is written by putting them side by side, if you can continue through the edges, or above, or in fact diagonally, or I mean it's all in topology, so it's not squarish, but that's a planar algebra. In practical terms, it just means all pictures you can draw out of these ingredients, in particular, these pictures. Okay? So without a formal definition, it just means all pictures you can draw. Okay, so it's the planar algebra generated by these things, but then I mod it out by lots of relations. I mean, even in ordinary knot theory, there are relations. So in ordinary knot theory, this is equivalent to that. This is the so-called Rademeister 2 move. And in ordinary knot theory, a crossing with a line going under is equivalent to a crossing with this line going above. So this is the Rademeister 3 move, and you can see it by sliding this strand under everything from the bottom to the top, right? So there are similar moves between in four dimensions, and here are the ones that I know. So first of all, there is the Rademeister 2. It also has a meaning in four dimensions, and it also holds. In fact, here's what it is. So I have two rings, one flies through the other, and then flies back. That's clearly homotopic to do nothing. Okay? Rademeister 3 is, now I have three, well, you know what, it's too hard. I mean, I only have two hands, and I need three rings, okay? Then there is, you can slide stuff under a vertex, but also over a vertex, that's the old types. Then there is virtual crossings, you can also do the same moves on them. Then there is this mixed move, which mixes two virtual crossings and an ordinary one. Then there is, well, you can slide a you can slide something over a virtual crossing. But actually, you cannot slide stuff under a virtual crossing. So since there is a bit of asymmetry here, maybe I should try to explain where this is coming from. So let's try to understand this, but now I need a volunteer. Bus?
No, if it's not too hard.
I don't care. I mean, okay, your only role is to hold this. Okay? Sorry.
I had one job.
So, no, I did it. So, this is, this stands for this ring. Okay? This ring is above everything. Above meant big. Okay? This will become a thick tube, which means big ring. Okay? Here are two small rings. They start at opposite sides of big ring, and then they interchange places externally. No.
Small ring goes through?
No, it's small ring go through, then, it's the wrong projection. What did I do wrong? I think I have it down here at a different, from a different angle, and this way it's better. So this is just rotated 90 degrees, and now it's easier. So this is big ring, and now it's rotation in a different. Exchange positions and then fly through. Sorry, two small rings exchange position and then fly through, or three small rings fly through and then exchange positions. It's clearly homotopic. Okay. Now let's try to look at the undercrossing. The same thing with undercrossings. So now this becomes let it go. So this now becomes a small ring. And these two are big rings. Okay, now you have to hold these two. And the move will, if you interpret it, will look like a small ring flies first through one and then through the other. But that's not remotely homotopic to first through this and then through that. Okay? So thank you. So basically, I'm trying to give you excuses for this relation holds, while its kind of counterpart, where you flip the crossing, does not hold. And there is a similar such asymmetry with another one of the relations. Maybe I will not go through it. Okay. So this, by the way, does not describe all of two knots, but only a subset of two knots, and even this only conjecturally. So we actually don't know that these are all the relations. You might think that it's only one dimension above the dimension in which we live, so we should fully understand it, but we actually don't know that these are all the relations. It's only all the relations we know. Okay? But anyway, this is the space that Zuzana and I study. Now, there is actually a little bit more into that space, because it has a few more operations. So one operation is this sort of planar algebra operation, so putting things side by side. But there are actually a few more operations. So in fact, already in ordinary knot theory, if you look at knotted graphs, there are kind of fun operations that you can do with them. So for example, if you have a knotted graph, this is a part of a knotted graph. So not a trivalent graph. And in fact, this could be knotted, right? I didn't draw it knotted, but it could be knotted. Then there is an unzip operation where you think of this line as being a zipper and you unzip it, which means you really replace it by two parallel lines which run the same way and connect they have to go in the same way. So this is the unzip operation. So on the level of the parameter space, it's the operation which takes this to that. Okay? And there is a similar thing in four dimensions. So if you have two vertices facing each other, then remember that this becomes a tube. So you can make two parallel of the copies of this tube and connect one of them to the left here and left here, and the other to the right and the right, and you get a picture like that, which is actually equivalent to that. But everything could be knotted inside. So there might be stuff going through this tube and it's still well defined, or this tube might be going through things and it's still well defined. Okay. There is also a second unzip. So if you have a vertex and the end of one of the sides is cut, so really this is a disk topologically. You can make two copies of the disk, shift one relative to the other, and connect one to the left and the other to the right, and okay? So at the end of the day, I get a very complicated algebraic structure, namely a planar algebra, all these compositions left to right and and diagonally and all that, and in addition also these unzip operations. But if you look again at the machine that I discussed before, the machines that I discussed before was I was starting from a group and creating a group ring. But I didn't have to start from a group. I could have started from arbitrarily complicated algebraic structures. So if you have more than one multiplication, well, I mean, you can still look at formal linear combinations of things, and then you can look at things which are ideals with respect to all available products. The notion of ideal generalizes to algebraic structures in which there are more products. And then the augmentation ideal still makes sense. These are just linear combinations in which the sum of coefficients is equal to zero. It is still an ideal. It still makes sense to look at powers of the augmentation ideal, except now you look at powers relative to all available products. Everything still makes sense. And now our theorem makes sense. So if you look at the set of all expansions for this crazy algebraic structure which contains in it a bit of four-dimensional topology, then it's equivalent to the set of solutions of the Kashiwa-Avern problem. It's equivalent to solving the Kashiwa-Avern problem. I have 2 minutes to go, and that's probably not enough to tell you why I'm here. Okay? So I'm here not because of that, but because of generalizations and extensions. So I'm here because Roland invited me, because we wanted to talk about basically, so today we talked about what's called W knots, so these two-dimensional knots in R4, but then there are ordinary knots and there is a similar picture for them and it's called the Concievich integral, and then there is something called virtual knots, which is somehow related to quantization of Levi algebras. And that's not even the reason I'm here. The reason I'm here is because somehow there are maps between all of these things, and the point is that what I really, really want to understand is knot theory. So the ordinary knot theory. An ordinary knot theory is happening here, and it's too hard. I mean, it has an expansion, but it turns out that this expansion is very, very hard to study, to actually compute in practice. It's the so-called Concievich integral, and it's really, really hard. But it embeds into virtual knot theory, and the theory of expansions for virtual knots actually has many, many, many quotients, including quotients that can be understood in principle in polynomial time. So there are polynomial time algorithms to compute various fragments of the expansions for virtual nodes, and therefore there are polynomial times way, polynomial time not, well, invariants of nodes that you can get by tracing these arrows. And that's why I'm really here, and now I'm 10 seconds after an hour, so I'll stop with my usual propaganda.
Questions?
If I could try a question on your theorem with Susanna Dunshaw, since it said there's a bijection between a set of homomorphisms and another set, is that the whole theorem? And is the iceberg that you don't have an explicit description? I mean, bijection between two sets is pretty weak as a statement, right?
Well, this is the whole of this theorem,
yeah,
but it's not the whole of the theory.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have a sequence of papers, and we can say, okay, I mean, we can compute things to a pretty high order. We can connect these disks with ordinary knots. There is somehow an obvious knot from ordinary knots to virtual knots, which is you just reinterpret crossings from. So basically, you can connect this to ordinary knots, and then ordinary knots are somehow related to the Dreifeld theory of associators, and we sort of explain how this is the Alexeyev-Tarossian work, but we give a topological explanation of it, so why associators are related to Kashiwara-Wern. And finally, there is a very intricate way to actually understand how to solve the Kashiwara-Wern problem in topological terms. Okay, so the theory is much bigger. The iceberg is much bigger than what I've described today.
It's not a mere existence statement.
What?
It's not a mere existence statement.
No. There is a written iceberg.
Okay.
Roland can testify.
More questions? Can I add to the iceberg and ask you about multiple zeta values that happen in usual knots? Do they happen in W knots?
Not directly. I mean, they happen in W knots via the relationship of W knots with U knots. But I don't know a direct way to see. No, but otherwise, no.
Well, before we thank the speaker again, we're having dinner plans. So if you want to join dinner, please stick around. Let's thank the speaker again.
Maybe I should have said everything that appears here in blue is clickable. So if you go to my website and the URL is given, then you click on this, this will link you to the papers.
Okay.